Victory or death!
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 He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door. When he first came to the mountain, his life was far away, on the road and hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast, and it don't last for long. Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia. I'm your host, Hank Reardon, the voice of freedom behind enemy lines here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, bringing you, the Patriots, the information you need to stay in the fight to preserve your liberty. This is episode 22-23, the 23rd episode of 2023. If it's your first time listening, you can check out Radio Free Virginia for more information. Look at some of the shirts I've got there that I think, if you're a patriot, you'll find amusing. And that will help support the show. Another way you can help support the show is to support the advertisers, and I'll get to them in a second. But why am I playing Rocky Mountain High? Well, I just got back from Colorado, and that is why there was not a podcast last week. In fact, I did record one. I had my portable microphone set up, and I recorded one. It just felt kind of rushed, and I didn't have the audio quality that I like to produce, and frankly, I was wiped. I'll get to why that is in a sec. But I flew out there on the 3rd of August and flew Frontier Airlines. And it's kind of funny because my wife took a trip the following weekend and a different airline, American. And she said it's awful. It's a nightmare. And I agree. We're paying more. We're receiving less. And we're receiving less quality. So if you have to pay more, but you get a premium for it, like, oh, well, okay, you know, we're paying more, but we're getting great service. They're dialed in. The staff is dialed in. Everything's awesome. Great. Okay, fine. But that's not it. And this is everywhere. You see it everywhere, and it's frustrating. We're all experiencing it. Some of it's inflation. Some of it's post-COVID. Some of it is still the hanging-ons of the pandemic and the things that happened. And I'm starting to wonder if there aren't a lot of key people that died in this pandemic, whether that's from vaccine reactions or side effects from the vaccine a year or so later, or from the COVID itself, long COVID, whatever. But, you know, enough key people, a critical mass of those key people throughout the world, because it seems to be happening around the world. It's not just America that seems to be messed up and falling apart. But anyway, back to Frontier Airlines. So Frontier Airlines is kind of your budget airline. Flew out of Raleigh, because what they do is, if you haven't flown in a while, you may not know this. You search in flight and you've, oh, great, $450, right? Well, yes, except that if you don't want to fly back leaving at 1 in the morning, you got to upgrade to pay a little more for the better departure time. You want to leave at 7 at night, or you want to leave at 4 in the afternoon, or 1 in the afternoon. Yeah, you got to pay extra. Unless you do what we did, what I did, which is find a flight that's a straight shot, and you can quite often not have to deal with that. You book directly through the airline, and that's what I did. Or rather, that's what my wife did for me, because I got fed up with the process. I was like, this is stupid. So she straightened it out, and that's that. So flew out to Colorado. Frontier Airlines used to be a great airline. I've flown them before. Now it's like cattle car. Very thin, hard plastic seats with a little bit of foam and padding on the backside. No real tray table, enough to fit a cup. That's it. And normally what I like to do is put the tray table down and kind of sleep on it. And I didn't get to do that on this one. No, the chairs don't recline. So the whole flight experience, when you mix in security and all the other nonsense that's involved, is like being imprisoned. I imagine, I've never been in prison, but I imagine that's what prison's like. You can't say what you want. You can't do what you want. You can't talk back, or you'll get smacked across the lip in the form of getting thrown off the plane. That's that. Just shut up and be quiet. Say yes, boss, or yes, massa, whichever you prefer, and just shut up and do what you're told. So go out to Colorado. The purpose of the trip was to go see my dad. I mentioned he had a stroke. He is struggling with, you know, as all stroke patients do, with coming to terms with things, with learning to reuse your brain and learning to reuse your body. Because imagine 20% of your brain, let's just nice round number, 20% of your brain doesn't work anymore the way it used to. Now the rest of the brain can compensate for that, but you have to teach it how to do that. So imagine your left leg that was controlled by one part of your brain, well, now that the rest of your brain has to learn how to reuse that left leg. And it's a long process. It's a year or two long process. And you'll see people that have had stroke and they've made it through. And they'll get back to, you know, 90, 95% of what they were. Maybe they won't be able to write. But, you know, stroke is no fun. I was thinking, I don't want to ever have one of these. But unfortunately, our medical industry, because of Obamacare, because of COVID, because of all these things, is not what it used to be. And they're warehousing these people. And my stepmom's taking great care of my dad. She's awesome. And she has been over there every day. Every day. And fought to get him out of the horrible place he was in after the hospital and get into a proper place, a place that cares. And this is skilled nursing, which then leads to, once you get past that, you get into assisted living, and then hopefully you can go home. And that's the kind of road they're on right now. And they're on the assisted living. So they're warehousing these people. And she said that, you know, because she was there every day, she saw this. The majority of the people, 90%, have nobody coming to visit them. That's sad. And some of that is the fault of these people. They've refused to leave where they live and live closer to family. Family moved away and probably said, hey, why don't you move closer to us? No, I'm fine. Well, you move 3,000 miles away from your family, or vice versa, they move away from you and you choose not to come. That's a choice you made and it sucks. And that's the situation that my dad is in, is because he has refused to leave Colorado. The funny thing is they don't really like Colorado. I mean, with the exception of, there are things to like about Colorado. I got to take I'll get to what I got to do while I was there in a sec. But, you know, they don't really like Colorado. The politics has turned communist, probably worse or as bad as California. The economics of it, because of that, it means higher taxes. There's a ton of people. Imagine you took, some of you that listen, maybe you're in a higher urban center, but we're not here in Central Virginia. But imagine you took the city of Lynchburg, double or triple its density, and then multiply its size by 10. And that's kind of a good idea of what you'd have between Denver and Boulder. Jam-packed, nonstop, wall-to-wall houses the entire way. So traffic everywhere, speed limits of 40 and 45. I mean, just 7 days a week traffic. I mean, who wants to live like that? $500,000 to $1 million homes. There's really not much cheaper unless it's in the hood. So I did get to do one fun thing. I got to take a hike, and it's the picture. If you're looking at the podcast, that's what that's from. It's from one of the hikes I got to take from about 5,000 to 7,000 foot of elevation. And only about 3 miles, although the Fitbit said I did 6, and I don't see how that's possible because the map said I did 3. But that 3 with no altitude acclimation felt like 6. Maybe that's what Fitbit was telling me. Hey, slowpoke, you're moving so slow. Let's give you a little bonus here. And you did 6 miles. Good for you. But dry, no humidity whatsoever. So that was awesome. I got to go for a walk every single day. that helped with getting a little bit more acclimated to the altitude. I had a headache the first 5 days I was there. Every morning I woke up, and about half of the evenings when I went to bed, just because of the less altitude. And so the no humidity was pretty awesome. I did discover that I do not have an intolerance to heat and humidity. I have an intolerance to humidity. Something has changed. You know, I've mentioned this before, but since I got COVID, I can't seem to cope when I'm out in the heat and humidity. I think it's just a combination of the two, but mostly it's the humidity. And so, you know, but I wouldn't trade Virginia for Colorado. No way. But had a great time. It was good to support my dad. We mostly sat around and watched TV or movies. Wicked Tuna is a pretty cool show, although I wouldn't want to subscribe to having commercials. Gosh, I don't know how any of you watch TV without on demand and having recorded it and then going back and watching it and skipping the commercials. It drives me insane. Mostly I would mute it, wait for the thing to be over, and then unmute it. You know, the drug ads and the side effects always crack me up. May lead to death. Oh, sign me up for that. What's that drug? The funny thing is the side effects for COVID don't list that, even though that has happened to many people. Not COVID, but the vaccine for COVID. So what am I going to talk about tonight other than what I just shared with you? Well, I'm going to talk about communist life, share with you something from that. And I'm going to start reading a book as part of the show. And this is The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates, and it's by Matthew J. Truheller. And it's really good. You're really going to like this. I think if we could adopt this and get this in the hands of all the lesser magistrates, the county supervisors, the bureaucrats, the state delegates, the governors, the state senators, the attorneys general, this is how we win. So I'm going to share that. It's a really good book on the concept, the doctrine of the lesser magistrate from a biblical perspective. I think you'll really enjoy it. So let's get to Soviet life here. But I said communist life, but let's get to Soviet life here. But before I do, I want to thank Adam Hopkins, adamhopkins.net. And Adam is a broker in the Forest, Virginia area, serving Forest and Amherst and Nelson, Appomattox, Campbell County, Bedford County, all the way out to Pamplin, actually. If you're looking for a good real estate agent, check out adamhopkins.net because he's got a great team of people, and he's good people, good solid patriot, and we need to support that parallel economy and support those patriots out there that are doing what's right and thinking the right way, because that's just as important. AdamHopkins.net. Okay, readers ask, Soviet life has received many letters from readers asking about the economic and political system of USSR and about life in general there. The questions, who holds state power? Well, let's read this one. Who holds state power in the Soviet Union? The Communist Party of the Soviet Union or the Soviets? The information which we Americans read in local sources leads us to believe that all the power in the Soviet Union belongs to the Communist Party. Is this true? Well, I'm going to give my answer first. Yes, this is true. The Soviet Party is the elite class. You have to be invited in to join the party. You join the party, and then you get special privileges. If you don't join the party, you're not a party member. You don't get those special privileges. You are a better class of citizen if you are a Soviet Party member. A Communist Party member. So, the answer they give. The state power in the USSR belongs to the Soviets. That'd be the people. The country is not a state of the Communist Party, but a Soviet state, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The Moscow Kremlin, where sessions of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR are held, is equivalent to the U.S. Capitol, which is not, as Americans know, the center of one political party or another in the U.S. The Constitution of the USSR reads, Article 1, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republic is a socialist state of the whole people, expressing the will and interests of the workers, peasants, and intelligentsia, the working people of all the nations and nationalities of the country. All power in the USSR belongs to the people. The people exercise state power through Soviets of the People's Deputies, which constitute the political foundations of the USSR. All other state bodies are under control of and accountable to the Soviets of People's Deputies. See, none of this makes sense. What are they even saying here? Something's lost in translation. No other force governs the Soviets as a system of power. All the laws in our country are legislated by the Soviets, and nobody, including the Communist Party, has a right to draw up, change, or repeal a law except the Soviets. The Soviets, and they alone, have the right to guide the country's economy and social and cultural development. They are in charge of all matters concerning state planning, the budget, national defense, and foreign relations. The highest body of the state authority of the USSR is the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, which consists of two equal chambers of 750 deputies each. The Soviet of the Union expresses the interests of the entire population of the country, and the Soviet of Nationalities represents the specific interests of the republics and nationalities. Like all the other Soviets, the USSR Supreme Soviet is formed on the basis of universal equal and direct suffrage by secret ballot. Its term is 5 years, with sessions convened twice a year. The Supreme Soviet's permanently functioning executive body is the Presidium. I immediately thought of this movie Logan's Run for some reason when I hear that word, the Presidium. The entire population of the country is represented in the Soviets. For instance, in the present USSR, Supreme Soviet elected in March 1979, more than half of the seats, 766 out of 1,500, are held by workers and farmers. The rest of the deputies are managers of industrial enterprises and offices, specialists from various sectors of the economy, teachers, doctors, writers, actors, Communist Party leaders, and statesmen. Also in the present Supreme Soviet are 425 non-party people. Oh, well, I was actually surprised to read that. 28.3% of the total. While the number of women is 487, 32.5%, the deputies represent 61 nationalities. This representation is also characteristic for the Soviets of other levels. Now to discuss the role of the CPSU in the running of the Soviet society. Article 6 of the Constitution of the USSR states, "The leading and guiding force of Soviet society and the nucleus of its political system, of all state organizations and public organizations, is the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. The CPSU exists for all peoples and serves the people. All party organizations shall function within the framework of the Constitution of the USSR. Above all, the extensive interpretation of the role of the Communist Party can be seen in these provisions. The point is not about the concrete prerogatives of the CPSU in the sphere of state power, but about its impact on the basic processes of development of the country. At the same time, the role of the Communist Party is defined in the fundamental law with utmost clarity. The constitutional embodiment of the party's leading role is of principled significance. As the masters of their country, the Soviet people have, in this way, expressed their complete faith in the CPSU. The CPSU does not enact laws, but all legislation, all of its aspects and problems, is studied in depth by the party before being passed. In no way does this limit the rights of the Soviets. On the contrary, practice shows that the party's participation can only encourage the initiative of both the state or public bodies and individual citizens, since there always exists a guarantee that the party will examine any major proposal carefully. The party takes part in guiding the activities of the Soviets, but does not act in place of them. It promotes its platform primarily through the communists who have been elected to the Soviets by the people and who work together on an equal footing with non-party people and state bodies. Today, communists account for about 40% of the total number of deputies. It is an honor to be elected to the Soviet, but at the same time, a deputy has a reasonable job. Deputies express the interests of the working people in the constituencies and are representatives of state interests in their given localities. Though the influence of communist deputies takes many different forms, they mainly analyze, explain, and show expediency or inexpediency of a proposed decision. Okay, a couple things. Essentially, these people are the mouthpieces that spew the propaganda of the state. If you remember what we learned about reading I Led Three Lives, We have a society of, we have a group of people being propagandized in the ways of communism. And when somebody is to take a leadership position, word is put out amongst key people that says, that's the guy. And everybody votes for that guy. They even, if you remember from the book, have dissenting opinions to make it look like there's actual debate going on. But there's not. Another thing I noticed that was a surprise to me and I mentioned was the amount of people that aren't party members who are appointed. However, we have to think about this from a communist standpoint is that could also be a lie. These people could be secret party members, as was the case often in America and many other countries. But when communists infiltrate, they get somebody to have a persona. Oh, you, sir, you're going to be a Baptist. You're going to go get very involved in the Baptist church, and you're going to be a good Republican. And we will use you to steer things the way we want them steered within your organizations, but that will be your public life. That will be who you are. And you're going to be a communist, though, really. And we're going to continue to train you and educate you in the ways of communism. So it's entirely possible that these supposed non-party people are actually communists. And then the other interesting thing is, and I will give one thing, I will give them credit. They do and did at the time have more women involved in public leadership, but that doesn't really say much because they were all speaking the voice of communism. So that really didn't matter. And I was wrong about one thing. The Soviets are not the people. They're the representatives of the people. So the Soviets and their deputies are essentially the our version of the delegates, congressmen, senator, things like that. I will continue doing these reader ask questions. They're quite informative. Communism is such an evil thing. They make it look so. Oh, it's so wonderful. Look at us. We're the people's people. Oh, we just love everybody, and everybody has a fair share. And if you disagree, we'll stick you in the gulag or shoot you in the head. I mean, that's what they did. The Lubyanka. You know, you went in one side alive, and you came out the other side dead. By the hundreds, every night. They built a special wall where they would put doors against it to absorb the bullets, and a special drain at the bottom to deal with the blood. And they would lean you up against the wall and shoot you. And then they would haul your body out. And that was that. Nobody ever heard from you again. This is the thing Alexander Solzhenitsyn says when he says, oh, how we burned in the camps later thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family. Or if during periods of mass arrest, as for example in Leningrad, when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, pawing with terror at every bang of the downstairs door, at every step on the staircase, but had understood that they had nothing left to lose, and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of a half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport. And notwithstanding all of Stalin's thirst, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If we didn't love freedom enough, and even more, we had no awareness of the real situation, we purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterward. It was from the Gulag Archipelago from 1918 to 1956. And it's actually one of the books on my reading list. It's deep stuff. I think I got through like 10 pages and I had to just stop. It was so rough. He's a good writer and it's a good book, but man, it's heavy stuff. And the Soviet state killed millions of people. Probably all the Soviet states combined, if you also add in fascism, which was essentially, and this is a leftist Marxist ideology, it's communism. you just called it fascism. Those ideologies killed 100 million people in the last century, and they will do it again gladly. This communist propaganda reminds me of a clip I've shared before, and this is Tom Tuttle from Tacoma, Washington, and he's in the Peace Corps, and he gets captured by these communist guys. I can't remember what country they're in or what. I think it's, I don't know. It's some Asian country, but it's a funny clip. It's John Candy. You know, he's since died, but it fits really well with what I just read to you.
Tom Tuttle von Tacoma, you will be brainwashed.
Me? America's son? Ha! That will be a challenge.
Our enemies are all those in league with imperialism. The bureaucrats, the big landlord class, and the reactionary section of the intelligentsia attached to them.
Very good, Tom. You quote the chairman well.
Our enemies are all around us. We must always be on our guard. Sure, we'll lose a lot of snooze time, but that's okay. We'll catch up after the revolution's over.
That's enough, Tom.
The leading force behind our revolution is the industrial proletariat. Our closest friends are the entire semi-proletariat and the petty bourgeoisie.
That's enough, Tom.
But there's so much more.
I said that's enough! The time has come to tell you your mission.
Oh, yes, my mission. I'd like that very much, comrade.
Good. Tom, the bridge you were building for the lying, malignant, snake-infested Yankee Peace Corps. That bridge is important to us. It gives us an easy access across the river. We can drive our brand new people's truck across it and plaster the words of the chairman on every tree, rock, and animal for miles until we run out of the people's gas.
Yes.
You, Tom Tuttle of Tacoma, are going to ensure that that bridge is built and that no one in Lung Ta interferes with our plans.
In a week, I'll have that village running like Peking. And if someone does stand in your way...
No! Enough. Yes, yes.
Next up is this book, The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrate. Before I get started, I want to talk about Act of Care of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/Blue-Ridge. And I, having spent time with my dad and experienced some of these industries, I can tell you that there are places where you go to warehouse family or warehouses, or where old people are warehoused until they die. And what John and his team do is solve that problem for you so that that's not what's happening. They provide in-home care to your senior loved one when you can't be there. It's real simple. And they have a good caring staff of people, and they're great people. John is a solid patriot. He is the best friend I have, and he's a great guy, and his business is awesome. And what he does, whether that's hospice care or whether that's in-home care, he provides a great service to the community. And if you're looking for that for your senior loved one, you should check him out. ACTIKARE.com/Blue-Ridge. And let him know you heard about it on Radio Free Virginia. The Doctrine of the Lesser Magistrates, a proper resistance to tyranny and the repudiation of unlimited obedience to civil government, by Matthew Trueheller. Acknowledgements. Though countless people have influenced my life and worldview, there are a few that I must thank for being instrumental in helping make this book a concrete reality. First, I would like to thank Paul and Sue Logan for the use of their cabin on the Mississippi River, a true oasis for thought, and getting the pen onto paper. I also want to thank Kathy Ramey, Dr. Patrick Johnson, Paul Korzenko, and Reverend Forsell Gappa for their help with syntax, as well as inspiring much thought as the work progressed. Thank you also to Kent Hovind, who, while in bonds, encouraged me to write further on this topic. I also want to thank my wife, Clara, whose love and encouragement for over 3 decades of marital union has made me a much better man. Rarely in life, so it seems these days, do two people taste the depths of the Lord's wisdom in establishing the institution of marriage. We taste it. The foundation of our union as husband and wife was sealed in Christ. The mortar of our union is our love and fealty to Him, and our undying love for one another. The fruit of our union is our children and our children's children. Words fail in expressing my love for her. If not for her, this book would not be in your hands right now. Finally, I would like to thank and honor those lesser magistrates who in years gone by have stood against tyranny, hazarding their lives in obedience and love for God, or simply their desire to do right. And to all those yet to come, may He give you wisdom and strength, and may you do right by Him. Introduction. In the course of human history, the abuse of authority by men through the arm of the state is not an uncommon occurrence. Western civilization has pillared safeguards to help prevent this. Nevertheless, a citizenry must remain vigilant and understand both the purpose and limitations of the state. If a citizenry does not know the purpose and limitations of the state, then the civil government can misuse its power because the citizenry is unable to measure when something improper is occurring. For there to be any indignation towards acts of tyranny by the state, one must be able to recognize that tyranny is taking place. Aldous Huxley, in his book Brave New World, wrote of a citizenry of slaves who would love their enslavement. Huxley writes, "A really efficient totalitarian state would be one in which the all-powerful executive of political bosses and their army of managers control a population of slaves who do not have to be coerced because they love their servitude." Unknowingly, Americans have accepted the role of Huxley's servant-minded people for decades. This is due in part to the fact that people love comfort and tend to avoid conflict. However, the other part of the equation is that people have lost the yardstick by which they should measure the limits of government. As a consequence, we in America have become a slave-like people, with the federal government acting more as a master than a servant providing justice for the people. When you go to Washington, D.C. today, you cannot help but notice that it has become like a fortress. The heavily fortified nature of the place reminds one of what Plato said to the tyrant Dionysius when he saw him on the streets of Sicily surrounded by his many bodyguards. "What harm have you done that you should need to have so many guards?" In a very real sense, one is right to say our federal government has harmed the American people. Review the current federal laws, policies, and bureaucracies, and you cannot help but see that it has caused much harm to the institutions and traditions of our people. It is as if, over the course of time, we have been attacked and plundered. In the past, the pulpits of our nation instructed the people in the purpose, functions, and limitations of the state. Many pastors preached every year what became known as election and artillery sermons. These sermons were routinely preached during the first 100 years of our nation. Clergymen understood and taught their congregations that God's word addressed all matters of life, including the matters of civil government. Today, however, most pulpits are silent about God's word when it comes to civil government. In fact, most just teach unlimited obedience to the state, as though there are no limitations to the state's rule. By default, they teach that whatever the civil government rules legislatively is therefore the will of God. This type of clergyman was even present near the Revolutionary War era. The Reverend William Gordon of Roxbury, Massachusetts, preached regarding such men in 1794 when he declared, "Though the partisans of arbitrary power will freely censure that preacher who speaks boldly for the liberties of the people, they will admire as an excellent divine the parson whose discourse is wholly in the opposite and teaches that magistrates have a divine right for doing wrong and are to be implicitly obeyed. Men professing Christianity, as if the religion of the blessed Jesus bound them to bow their neck to any tyrant. The authority of the state does have limits. America's present-day pulpits need to repent of their idolatrous views regarding the state. True Christianity produces liberty. Even the Christ-hating 17th-century philosopher David Hume had to admit the precious sparks of liberty were kindled and preserved by the Puritans in England, and that to this sect, whose principles appear so frivolous and whose habits so ridiculous, the English owe the whole freedom of their constitution." The church pulpits are the historical means whereby the people are instructed, from a theological foundation, in the purpose, functions, and limitations of the state. When a citizenry's view of the state is theologically driven, the state can no longer get away with doing whatever just tickles its fancy. This is because an informed citizenry, one which recognizes transcendent law, is vigilant and will not tolerate abuse or tyranny. 1 Corinthians 7:23 commands, "Do not become the slaves of men." Because of human nature, however, men tend to want to be ruled and cared for, rather than take on responsibility and cherish liberty. Because of human nature, tyranny, from time to time, raises its ugly head. Because of human nature, men will endure a long train of abuses and usurpations. However, men will endure a long train of abuses and usurpations only to a certain point. When the civil government continues to assault men's rights and liberties through unconstitutional, unjust, or immoral laws, policies, or bureaucratic decrees, honorable men will eventually weary of it and begin to take a stand. Those men who do begin to take a stand, however, want to be assured that their efforts are legitimate and proper. Thankfully, America's founders established three well-known boxes by which we can preserve liberty and resist tyranny. They are the ballot box, the jury box, and the cartridge box. The ballot box provides opportunity to remove unjust rulers through the vote. The jury box provides citizens not only the right to judge the facts in a case, but to judge the law itself. The jury can determine whether a law is being misapplied or can find a law unjust or immoral altogether. The jury can acquit on either basis, regardless of what the judge or jury instructions say. The cartridge box refers to an armed citizenry. America's founders knew that an armed citizenry not only helps repel an invading foreign force, but also acts as a check against tyranny from our own government. But a lesser-known tool, which the founders themselves employed, is the doctrine of the lesser magistrates. The lesser magistrate doctrine provides the best means to rein in higher authority that has spurned its limitations. The doctrine of the lesser magistrates is rooted in Scripture and found throughout the history of mankind. The doctrine offers great hope to a nation of people who groan under the yoke of tyrannical behavior by the state. This book assumes that the reader already understands the dire condition of America. There have been countless books written over the last 20 years detailing America's demise and the march towards tyranny via the federal government. This book spends little time decrying darkness. Rather, this book is meant to bring hope and encouragement. It places within the hands of those concerned about our nation a blueprint and means by which a stand can be made against a federal government that has trampled our Constitution, assaulted our person, liberty, and property, and impugns the law of God. Americans are now nearly a completely conquered people. We do not have to sit by, hand-wringing and passively submitting to our own destruction, however. The doctrine of the lesser magistrates provides a legitimate and proper means to restore order and resist tyranny. History has proven that peasant revolts are easily put down by the state. The lesser magistrate doctrine is effective in quelling abuses by higher authority, and does so often without the shedding of blood. This book is not, nor is it intended to be, a comprehensive or exhaustive declaration of the lesser magistrate doctrine. Rather, it is intended to be a primer. It is a starting place from which deeper study can be done by individuals. It is my hope that this book incites others to write further on this doctrine and awakens people to a deeper love and fear for God and a greater vigilance to preserve liberty. My prayer is that this book might be useful in stopping America's death march into tyranny and oppression, and point men back to Christ and His rule. Matthew Trueheller, Epiphany 2013, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So that's that, and I'm going to continue on. I'll read a chapter per episode here and give my commentary and thoughts on this. I really like this. I really think that this could be what we need to see. If you think about this from a 10th Amendment standpoint in our Constitution, that the whole concept of that is the doctrine of the lesser magistrates, that power not expressly delegated to you is not yours. And so when government, the federal government, takes that power, the lesser magistrate can say, no. And I've been saying this for years. Why doesn't the state governor just say, no, we're not doing it? I think to an extent what we see happening in Texas, where they're busing the migrants to Washington, D.C. and New York City because the government, the federal government, isn't doing its job in securing the border, is genius. That's a lesser magistrate, a governor, saying, I don't think so, putting these people on buses and sending them up north. So I think there's a lot we can learn from this book and that we can apply to the patriot cause. Because if one day we have to do patriot stuff, and if you've listened to this show any length, you know what I'm talking about, then it needs to be done the right way. And it needs to be done when all lawful and biblical means of resistance are done and finished. And maybe we're already there. I don't know. But maybe we're not. So I hope you enjoy this book. I'd like to thank you for listening. Remind you, you were not made to fit in. You were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon. This is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.
Rocky Mountain High,
Colorado.
Rocky Mountain High.